Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm Scott Pianowski. It is Monday, September 21st, and here we come charging down the stretch of the fantasy baseball season. We made it. 2-month sprint. There's been some bumps along the way. There's been some scheduling quirks and, of course, a whole lot of injuries, but we've gotten to the final week of the season, and it's about time we had this guest on. You know Steve Gardner from, he's the linchpin of labor. He's a senior fantasy editor at USA Today Sports, been a member of the fantasy baseball industry for a long time, a BBWAA member, FSWA member, just a really good dude to talk sports, to talk life, to talk music. We'll be talking about female members of the sports media in our draft later today, which will be really fun. But before we get to that, let's just say hello to Steve and let's talk some baseball. Hello, Mr. Gardner.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this today.
Me too. And look, it's the final week. We're going to try to give you some takeaways that maybe you can apply to the upcoming 2021 season. And obviously, it's been an unusual year. What stuff has happened that's real? What's maybe more just temporary? But before I get into that, Steve, I know you're the guy who runs labor, and I know that you and Fred Zinke and some other people are having a heck of a battle there. What type of fantasy season has it been for you? And are you in line to win a couple of championships? You're having a good year. Just give us a sense of where you're at in 2020.
It's been actually a pretty good year, to tell you the truth, Scott. So thankfully, I don't know that there was really anything that I can, hang my hat on, though, because in such a short season, it's so wacky, it's so random that you really can't say, wow, I just nailed that league or I killed that draft. But you hang around. And I think this is what shows for good players. You just try and make the best moves you can and incrementally get better every single week during the season. And if you miraculously are able to do that and avoid huge injuries, you might find yourself in contention at the end. So, yeah, that's the league that that we're in, the Labor Mixed League. 4.5 points out of first place behind Fred Zinke. And Fred will come up a little bit later on, too, in this recitation. But a lot of teams up there. I think we've got, 5 teams within 4.5 points of first. So that's going to be a knockdown, drag-out finish. I also, because I run the leagues, I get to be in all of the labor leagues. So in 4th place in AL labor and in NL labor up there as well. We've got 7 teams, I think, that are within 10 points of first place going into the final week. So I'm 6th there, but could easily be 2nd or, dead in the water by Wednesday. And then the big one for me is Tout Wars NL, and that Fred Zinke and I are battling head-to-head and have been the entire year, it seems like. And somehow or another, I opened up a little bit of a lead yesterday as we turn for home. So final week of the season, I've got a slight lead on Fred, but those categories are so close that it could be anybody's game. It's one of those things. One of the things I wrote about too, Scott, in my Sports Weekly column that comes out on Wednesday, is you can always say for this season, I didn't lose, I just ran out of time. I think that's appropriate.
Right. Yeah, well put. Obviously, I have much respect to the fantasy industry, but Fred Zinke's a very difficult guy to beat. So I'm not surprised that you're going heads up with him in a couple of leagues. And as you mentioned, the labor mixed league with you and Ryan Bloomfield, and there's 5 teams. All could win it in the final week. And, it's interesting. I mean, baseball kind of got rid of the pennant race by all the playoff teams are inviting this year in this big tournament. But some of these fantasy races are crazy where you just see the shifting. You can gain 5 or 10 points in a night. One bad pitching outing or one great pitching outing can elevate you. You only need a stolen base or two to sometimes gain some points there. So it's turned into, I think, a very exciting season. I know it wasn't a full year, and we think of baseball as a 6-month season and everything, and so we don't have the time for things to kind of smooth out, and there's been a lot of randomness. There'll be some players who end up with really crazy low batting averages this year or whatever, but I've come around to the season. I'm glad that it got off without any major catastrophe. There were some really big bumps in the road early, but I'm going to look back on the season a lot more fondly than I would have thought maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people talk about how fantasy baseball takes so much work and effort and everything, and fantasy football is so much easier because the games are only once a week, and you can set everything up for those games on Sunday and Monday. This fantasy baseball season has been essentially a fantasy football version of baseball. And for, like you were saying, Scott, I think it's made a lot of excitement, and it's going to be just... As I said earlier, it's going to be ridiculous these last couple of days because we don't have that whole bulk of stats that are already built up over the course of 25 weeks of the season. It's only been 8, and we're going to see a lot of movement in the final week and maybe the final day.
You know, I'm so glad you made that parallel between fantasy baseball and fantasy football. And of course, if you are a fantasy football player, I want you to know we have 5 fantasy football podcast coming at you. The Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast is what we call it. So you'll be sure to listen to those programs. And you can still draft a team on Yahoo Fantasy if you want to. We've seen a lot of injuries in fantasy football this year. And one of the challenges is just trying to get a healthy team you feel good about. And that's also been an issue with fantasy baseball this year. We know the Marlins didn't play for an extended period of time. It felt like the Cardinals had like a month off when they had an outbreak. And of course, there's been injuries as well. And I guess... whether you want to apply it to baseball or football or sports in general, I always feel like just getting a team as healthy as possible, some of that's going to be luck. But there's going to be some best practices, whether it's maybe drafting a younger team or trying to stay away from certain injuries. Take this anywhere you want. Can we actually be smarter about constructing teams that are going to stay healthy? Or do you think that's just maybe a fool's errand? It's more luck than anything. What's your view on trying to build the healthiest team we can?
Yeah, I kind of don't mind to take risks occasionally on guys that aren't necessarily the picture of health. I mean, I think it's smart, especially at the beginning of the year, to go ahead and take a guy that may come at an injury discount because you can stash him on the injured reserve list, go out and pick out somebody from the free agent pool when it's essentially at its richest, and maybe kind of improve your roster to some degree even before the season gets started. So, yeah, you don't want to have certainly all of your best players on the injured list to start the season. But I'm not somebody who really tries to make sure that I draft a healthy team. I just want to make sure that I have a healthy team on the field in my active lineup every week. And I can move those players in and out as they get healthy and replace the injured guys.
Let's talk about some of the takeaways from this season and maybe if we think they're applicable to further seasons. One thing we have seen is the striation of saves, which was a trend that's been going on for a while, has never been like it is this year. Tampa Bay just tied a record for the most different players to record a save in a season, and they did it in a two-month season. That's incredible. 12 different Rays have recorded a save. So I guess you can look at this two different ways. A lot of people will say, well, there's so much uncertainty with closers. It's frustrating. I'm pulling my hair out. But we also need fewer saves to be competitive. And I've kind of turned into the skid and said, okay, well, I don't have to sweat saves as much because I don't need as many. How has your view on saves changed, if at all? And just give us the Steve Gardner view on the bullpen landscape these days.
Well, for this season, and we have to say that this is a unique situation, although the trend is going the way that you mentioned it, this season it seemed to me like relievers were going to be more valuable than ever before because they were going to get more chances to pick up wins. And if you got a chance to maybe get a guy who wasn't the lockdown, king of the bullpen and who gets the saves on the team, to maybe get one or two guys. And one of the things that I did in AL labor, for instance, I mean, Nick Anderson is a guy that I loved, but you know, the strikeouts and the ratios were fantastic. But was he going to get all the saves? As it turned out, I picked the bullpen, you know, as you said, was going to be setting records for most guys in the pen getting a save. I got Diego Castillo as well. So I kind of got a representative sample of some of those saves, and I could go, you know, look for a Liam Hendricks or somebody that was kind of a safe guy to get saves elsewhere. So I think that's one of the things in terms of getting saves. The other point to what you were saying, Scott, is that you can trade for these guys too. And I think that's one of the things. Don't sweat it early in the season because you can possibly find somebody that has a surplus. Who was it? Larry Schechter in AL labor had a ton of extra saves and tried his best to trade his way out of that. I think he's still going to win saves by a very comfortable margin. That's one of those things. Can you manage what you have in surplus and get some of the things that you have, a lack of?
Yeah, I think it was Ron Chandler who said a long time ago, draft for value and then balance your team during the season. And you know, we talk a lot about in a rotisserie league, you're trying to just work the categories and make the puzzle mm-hmm. work for you. And you're going to have excess in certain areas. And hopefully you can be able to shape your roster later to make that puzzle work for you. I've always been a fan of knockout relievers, whether they're getting saves or not. We saw Anderson last year. Got some saves at the end of the year in Tampa Bay. He wasn't really a closer with the Marlins earlier in the season. Nobody knew a thing about Nick Anderson before the season. And I always feel like there's going to be some guys like that who pop every year. And look, I couldn't have picked up Devin Williams from a police lineup six months ago. And this guy, his stats are like wiffle ball stats. He's got 23 innings, 47 strikeouts, an ERA of 0.39, a whip .0, 0.61. He's picked up three wins, and we're seeing more relief wins than ever before. Starters don't go as deep. It's not a big deal anymore for starters removed from a game with a lead, like in the fourth or fifth inning. That used to never happen. You know, the pitcher would give the manager a sideways look if it happened once in a while. Now that's kind of common. If they don't want that pitcher exposed to another lap around the lineup, they'll take him out. I feel like the takeaway with Devin Williams and with maybe Nick Anderson is that what I like to do every year, and I'll say this next year in April, I'm sure, is wait a few weeks, look on your waiver wire, say, oh, here's a guy I've never heard of who has two walks and 13 strikeouts, and pick up that guy. They're not all going to last. Some of them could be flashes in the pan. They could obviously be hurt in a couple of days. Who knows? But I feel like it's an era of the fire-breathing dragon in the bullpen, and there's going to be a Nick Anderson or a Devin Williams every season, a few of these guys, and we can get them for the lowest acquisition.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, too, those guys become the best pitcher in the bullpen, and they get saves as a result, or save opportunities as a result. So, you know, like what Nick Anderson did last year at the end of the season, it would not surprise me if next year for the Brewers, Josh Hader, Devin Williams comes into that Corey Knebel role and kind of splits some save opportunities to give Josh Hader a break, those sorts of things. So, yeah, those guys, and it seems like they're available all the time, and just sort through them, keep the ones you like, throw out the ones you don't.
Yeah, I'm looking at Yahoo has a thing called MVPs, which shows the players who appear most often on the top 500 public league teams. And one thing, I'm having an okay year. I'm not having a great year. I'm having an okay year. I may win the Yahoo Friends and Family League. I'm not doing particularly well in the labor league that we're in together. But I'm looking at some of these common link players who are on the best teams in Yahoo, and I see Shane Bieber, don't have any of them. Mm-hmm. I see Manny Machado, don't have any of them. I don't have any Ryan Pressly. I don't have any Zach Plesac. I don't have any Liam Hendricks. I do have some Jose Abreu and some of these other guys down the list, but I'm curious, is there a common link player? You're having a bunch of teams in contention. Did you land on some of the right answers? Do you have a lot of Yu Darvish this year? Do you have a lot of Bieber? Is there a couple of players you can point to as maybe a secret of your success? And if so, what can we learn from those players?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, whether it's conscious or subconscious, I tend to kind of draft each team that I pick and add variety. If I don't like one guy, if I have two guys that are even, say a Yelich or Bellinger, for instance, if I have that choice, which was not a great choice to have for those two guys this year, but maybe I'll take Bellinger on one team and Yelich on another. And I diversify. The one thing I don't want to do is have one guy sink me in multiple leagues. So I think for that reason, I have to build each of my teams kind of separately, and I don't have the way that I did back. I remember one guy, Jose Abreu, back in his first year in the league, had talked to some people who had some interesting insights into him in Cuba, and I did get Jose Abreu. I was the Jose Abreu guy that year, and it ended up working out really well for me. But in general, I don't really do that, and I looked at some of the guys that are on my teams across multiple leagues, and there's a Mike Fiers, guys like that don't necessarily contribute to me being towards the top of the league. Machado was one of those guys, though, that I did think was going to have a bounce back season. So he was on a couple of my teams. But otherwise, it's just you look for value wherever you can find it. And generally, most drafts, you'll find it in different places.
I'm glad you mentioned Fires. I always feel like there's a sneaky Oakland pitcher who has value, and Chris Bassett's been one of those guys this year. Just seems like every time he starts six innings, a couple of runs, a handful of strikeouts, maybe in position to get a win. They generally have a good defense, although they don't have Matt Chapman for the end of the season. And what a shame. It's just so much fun to watch him play third base. We talked about the way the bullpens seem to be changing in baseball the last few seasons. Could you think about maybe some other trends or things, whether they're unique to 2020 or the last few seasons? We know the three true outcomes have started to dominate the game. Just give us a takeaway from what's gone on in baseball this year and maybe how we'll apply it forward.
Well, I think we look at stolen bases. I think that's one of the things that you have to you see in terms of trends. The two trends that are dominant for the past decade and have remained essentially in the same direction: stolen bases declining on the hitting side, strikeouts increasing on the pitching side. And so, number one, for stolen bases, you've got to get some source. You've got to have a strategy. Maybe the strategy is you punt stolen bases and turn your attention elsewhere. But you know, it's ridiculous to me to see a guy that has so little real world value, like an Adalberto Mondesi, who a couple weeks ago I noticed was last in the majors in on-base percentage and last in slugging percentage for qualified hitters. But yet, because of all of his stolen bases, he's a top 30 offensive player in fantasy baseball. So that's where the disconnect comes in. And you've got to plan out some sort of strategy. Do you go ahead and, you know, take one of those kinds of speed-only guys? If you took Malik Smith this year instead of Adalberto Mondesi, you saw him do absolutely nothing and get demoted to the alternate site. But those guys were kind of, you know, comparable players if you were going to go with that strategy. Billy Hamilton essentially has no team. A few years ago, he was one of the guys that you were bidding $20, $25 on because of his stolen base ability. So I think you've got to have a strategy for steals. And for strikeouts, you really have to get strikeouts from every single pitching spot on your roster, in roto leagues, that is. And be aware of that, because it's going to take so many. It's kind of the same way with home runs, with the rabbit ball coming in. You've just got to get so many, and you can't really let your guard down. You've got to be able to add strikeouts wherever you can, whenever you can.
Yeah, when you think you have enough strikeouts, go out and get some more strikeouts. And again, maybe that may be from a relief pitcher. You know, maybe it may be from a Devin Williams who has as many strikeouts as a good starter may have. That's certainly a key. You know, when it comes to stolen bases, a lot of times too, I look at what is the team philosophy? And I look at like Seattle, okay? I had no expectations on Dylan Moore before the season, but when he started to produce early in the year, and I saw Seattle seem to have an open approach to, look, we're not really going anywhere. Maybe we can do something on the bases. And we've seen teams have learned that the stolen base isn't really all that valuable in today's game, which is so dominated by home runs and strikeouts. But Seattle seemed to be like, hey, we want to run. I remember when Jonathan Villar was picked up by the Orioles a couple of years ago, and they just said, hey, bat leadoff, run whenever you want. We don't care. And I like that. You know, it almost feels like if I want stolen bases, I'm looking at a lot of the leaders in the stolen bases right now, and it's on teams that aren't contending. You know, Whit Merrifield on the Royals has double-digit steals. I mentioned the Mariners, Kansas City with Mondesi. You know, they're nowhere near contention. It's just funny how the team profile, I think, sometimes also ties into our strategy on stolen bases.
Yeah, and that goes to the managers, too, a lot of times. You look at Mike Matheny, who liked to run in St. Louis. Let him run in Kansas City. And I think that's one of the things, too. We can do a little scouting report on managers and some of their tendencies at the beginning of the season to kind of get a better handle on which teams will run, you know, which teams will do any number of different things. So that's one of the things, again, when you get ready to start preparing for 2021, that's another thing you can look at.
And, you know, to kind of pivot off stolen bases, but also tie them in, one of the players I got right this year, and this was just, I think I had a good process, but I just got lucky with the payoff, is I saw that Isaiah Kiner-Falefa was going to have a regular job in Texas, and he had catcher eligibility in most leagues. I know he has catcher eligibility in Yahoo. And I thought, okay, well, this could be one of my favorite things. A catcher who doesn't really catch, and he'll be in the lineup most of the time. I wasn't sure how the new park would play. He hasn't been all that special an offensive player. He has a good average, but the rest of his stats are kind of tame. But he's got 24 runs scored. He's stolen 8 bases. He qualifies at 3 different positions. So he just checks a lot of boxes for me. Sneaky stolen bases. I got him basically for nothing. He's a catcher who doesn't catch. And I love the versatility. And, you know, in a COVID year, just getting a team on the field and having somebody who can bounce the 3 different positions has been really valuable. Austin Nola, who hasn't been quite as good with San Diego, but he was really good with Seattle before he got traded. Another guy, catcher, first base, second base. Having those two guys in a couple of my teams has afforded me a ton of flexibility.
Indeed. And that was one of the things, too, especially in leagues like labor, where in the auction leagues, you can't freely move guys from reserve to bench, and you need that position flexibility. David Fletcher was one of the guys that I loved this season coming into the league, coming into the draft, because he was eligible all through the infield and in the outfield and could go, you know, move to whatever position and allow me, when I'm searching the waiver wire to fill one spot, to move Fletcher to the guy who I was replacing and have essentially my pick of any position to put in for a free agent. So that was one of the things. And to see him with all of that position eligibility jump off the board was certainly a, hey, pick me kind of thing.
Yeah, Tommy Lestell is another guy. Qualifies at multiple positions and had a nice run with the Angels before he was traded to Oakland. And then when you're making your pickup or you're making activating somebody off the bench, all of a sudden you can go best player available because you have this flexibility. I think it's really useful. Now, one rule change we made in labor this year, it's usually a league with weekly transactions. And you shifted to a model where we could make transactions on Mondays and then on Fridays. I think just with the hitters on Fridays. Mm-hmm. That's something that the NFFC or the NFBC, I should say, has done. Of course, in Yahoo, there's tons of different formats. The Friends and Family League I run is a daily transaction format. I realize that isn't for everybody. Where do you think we're at going forward in labor? Do you like going back to a weekly model? Do you think the Friday model has some traction to it? We saw this year with baseball, right? They tried some different things. 7-inning doubleheaders, that gimmick with the second, the runner on second base in extra innings. I don't know what's staying and what isn't staying. They had the DH in the National League this year. So you can comment on any of the baseball changes if you want, if you think they're going to stick. And I'm curious if what we're going to do in labor going forward, do you think the double transaction period is a good move or just maybe a one-time thing?
I'll tell you, I will take the temperature of the league and see what people thought about it. From a personal standpoint, I don't like being able to change midweek. I think just go ahead, set your lineup at the beginning of the week. I know I'm deathly afraid of forgetting something in a league that changes daily. And so I try to avoid those if at all possible. But it's, I think it was a compromise, number one, that we could make to the COVID situation in labor. And one of the things that we tried to do is just because we drafted so early back in February, and then the season ended up starting in July with that long span in between being getting our original rosters and being able to do anything with them, it seemed like that was a good way to kind of give owners a more of a flexibility to be able to change their lineups and react to those, you know, things that would happen with no warning, you know, guys testing positive, teams not being able to play, that sort of thing. So I think it worked out well for our situation in mixed labor. I don't know that I'm really in favor of it 100% going forward. It was another thing for me as commissioner to have to look after to make sure that everybody's lineup was working. We had some things technically that didn't always work all the time. So for that reason, I think I would prefer maybe to go back to a once a week lineup change, hard stop. But it did, I thought, work out well for us in this particular season.
Now let's look at baseball for a second. With 7-inning doubleheaders, the ghost runner on second base in extra innings, the DH universally, where do you stand on some of those things?
I don't know. Does it make me a purist if I say I don't like the seven inning doubleheader? I don't like the runner on second. I especially don't like the runner on second base to start extra innings. I mean, I want to know how that runner got there, and I want the box score to be able to tell me. And it just seems completely wrong. So I understand, you know, to try and get to a quicker end. Maybe for this year, again, that's a 2020 thing. I think we have to go back to just regular extra inning games. Who doesn't like free baseball? I mean, except the people that are on deadline trying to write about it. As for the universal DH, however, I think this is something that is going to be here to stay, and I'm not going to resist that change at all. I think it makes perfect sense now because hitters and pitchers are so specialized and are so good at what they do, to ask you know, a starting pitcher to go up there and try and swing the bat is just asking so much, and run the bases and risk injury and things like that. Granted, you've got a Shohei Ohtani, you've got a Michael Lorenzen, guys who can do both, and I think that's wonderful and should be celebrated. But for the most part, pitchers can't hit. I think we the stats bear that out. And I think we should go to a full-time DH starting next year, or continuing next year and beyond.
Yeah, I think we line up on all three of those things. I would definitely get rid of the 10th inning gimmick. I would prefer, now we know baseball doesn't like doubleheaders anyway, and there was an unusual situation this year with scheduling where they just became necessary. So I get why they went to the double sevens this year. Let's get rid of that. For years, my DH stance was, well, there's American League baseball, there's National League baseball. It's diversity. I wouldn't want every park to have the same dimensions, you know? So I used to embrace that side of it, and it added a little bit of extra strategy just of National League pitcher. Not that it was anything that complicated. Everybody knew the National League was kind of the safer, you know, two similar pitchers go with the National League pitcher. But as the more I've thought about it, if it keeps more of the better players on the field, if it means pitchers will get hurt less frequently, if it means that some of our players who would normally get benched could take a semi day off as a DH, or just gives us more playable players in the National League with that DH, or now, you know, when we have Nelson Cruz in a National League park, he's still playing, stuff like that. I've come around to it. I wouldn't mind if they switch back, but if I was the person making that decision, I'd say, okay, I'm with it now. Let's just go DH universally.
Yeah, and the thing too, I mean, starting pitchers are going, you know, shorter stints in games anyway. So how many times are they going to come up? Well, then what are you going to do? You're going to pinch hit and you're going to blow a bench spot? I mean, because rosters now are more heavily tilted toward more pitchers than hitters, you're going to end up maybe with relief. If the pitchers do hit again, you'll end up with relief pitchers batting in the sixth inning or the fifth inning or whatever. And that talk about strategy all you want. That's just boring. And so I would much rather have a professional hitter come up there in you know, in that spot and be able to give us something, you know, exciting to watch instead of another strikeout.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's ever said, you know what I miss is that 138 hitting pitcher coming up and striking out on three pitch. I mean, granted, if you had the pitcher throwing to him for your fantasy team, you might like it. But or yeah, I miss watching those guys bunt, you know? I miss, you know, I guess I kind of do miss them running the bases with the jacket on. There's something that it just seems so goofy that I think I kind of like that. But yeah, if I, and as you said, some guys can hit. You know, Ohtani can hit, Lorenzen can hit, Rick Ankiel can hit. That famous Braves rotation in the 90s, they used to take a lot of pride in their hitting. Rick Rodin was a good hitter. Tim Lawler could hit. And it used to be funny.
Terry Forster.
Sure, Terry Forster, yeah. And you would see like extra inning games sometimes when they'd run out of good hitters, they'd have to occasionally be like, okay, which of our pitchers can hit? We're going to send him up in the 13th or the 15th inning because weird baseball had taken over. And I love weird baseball. I love it when there's this, everybody on Twitter kind of realizes, hey, wait a minute, they're still playing in San Diego. Everybody turn on the Padres game, you know, and some players playing out of position and all that stuff. That gets really fun. So I think we're on the same page there. I mentioned the Padres just anecdotally. I don't have any Fernando Tatis Jr. this year, which I did. It just didn't fall that way for me. Right now, he's the number two hitter in Yahoo 5x5 value. He's actually been passed by Manny Machado, and there's a great National League MVP chase going on right now. Freddie Freeman might be in that argument. If I were to put you on the clock right now, Steve Gardner, We know Mike Trout, you know, when has anybody ever lost money on that guy? Tatis just had a breakout season. Betts has been everything the Dodgers expected. Jose Ramirez, a five-category player, a power and speed source. If you had the first pick right now, you know, maybe you'd go to Ronald Acuna, who's hurt part of the year, but he's been a monster when he's been healthy. Who do you think the number one player is going to be next year?
Had to think about this for my season-ending column too, Scott. So I will tell you, I mulled that over and had a top five that I think I would be happy with any of those guys. But when it came down to ranking them, I put Ronald Acuna at the top just because of youth, home run hitting ability, slugging ability, base running ability. I mean, he was so close to 40-40 last season. I still don't think that what we've seen this year with the injuries and all is anything that is going to knock him down off of that. So I'm, for the second year in a row, I think I'm going to have Acuna as my number one player going into the drafts next year.
You know, I'm a Red Sox guy. Mookie Betts was somebody I fell in love with the first day he played a game. He came up as a second baseman, turned himself into a Gold Glove right fielder. I told my friend Lisa when he was traded to the Dodgers, I said, you're going to love Mookie because he's great at everything. He's a great base runner. He's a great teammate. He's a great fielder. He can hit home runs. He can hit for average. He's smart. He's just going to all the stuff you'd want in a baseball player he's going to do. But I wasn't sure when he went to LA, would he still run? I mean, they have so many power hitters behind him. It is a new league. It is a new park. He is going to buy a new house, all that stuff. But what I've seen from him, and when I think of the lineup behind him, man, I'm going to want Mookie Betts on my team next year. I'm not saying I'm going to necessarily pick him first, but I still think he's in the prime of his career. And maybe it's just because I'm scarred this year having no Tatis. I need to accept that monster seasons can happen in San Diego. When Petco Park first came in, it was Death Valley. Right. You know, it was just so hard. You'd see balls that were clobbered and didn't even make it to the warning track. But there's been some infrastructure changes around the park. They have moved the fences in. Tatis still is interested in running. He plays a position. No, granted, shortstop's become an easy position to fill, so it's not really a position scarcity question anymore. But because I didn't have any Tatis last year, and you know, we both like that salary cap format, you know, what you call an auction format, we can pick your player. I think I just want to make sure I have at least one share of him next year because he's been such a fun guy to watch.
Yep, no doubt. And the one share that I had with Tatis on one of my teams, we didn't play this year, and because of all the problems getting everybody together and everything, so we ended up playing actually a Yahoo Points League just for the shortened season. So I'll get to go back and have Fernando Tatis as a $1 player in that keeper league next year. So I'm looking real forward to that. But you're talking about Betts too. I think Betts and Acuna are right up there in what they can do and in great offenses. They're my one and two. So either one of those, I would be very happy to start my franchise with next season.
I'm not sure what the right takeaway is for starting pitching when we look back to it. And again, with a 2 month season, and maybe there isn't a takeaway, but I'm just going to look at the top of the board in Yahoo drafts. And Gerrit Cole was the first player drafted as starting pitcher in Yahoo leagues. And he's been in very good. The ERA is a little bit higher than you'd expect, but you know, the whip is under one. He's getting 87 strikeouts. Mm-hmm. He's been great. Jacob deGrom, right back in the Cy Young chase. You know, he's been terrific. Scherzer, step back. Bueller's been hurt part of the season. He's only been okay. Jack Flaherty has had a disappointing season, and maybe that, you know, St. Louis not playing for a long time has played into it. Strasburg got hurt again. Verlander, of course, you basically had no season. He just made one start. He's headed towards Tommy John surgery. So I'm going to cherry pick this list because the next pitcher is Bieber, and he's been terrific. But only two of the top seven pitchers do I feel return full value. What's the pitching takeaway, if any, from what these guys did and how we might approach the vanity pitching guys in 2021?
Yeah, I think because of the short season, the reason that those guys were and have been historically valuable in fantasy leagues is because they've taken the ball and they've gone out there every fifth day and they have cranked up 10 strikeouts and pitched deep into games and had a chance to get a win. And I think that's where the value, at least when I was drafting, as we were getting close to starting this season, I was kind of shying away from the guys at the top of the pitching pool just because I didn't feel like they were going to have that kind of huge advantage. The Scherzer, you know, Scherzer, just a machine. It goes out there every game. Cole, same thing. DeGrom, those guys over a full season are going to distance themselves from the second tier pitchers and the third tier pitchers. And they didn't really get a chance to do that. I mean, look at Jack Flaherty last season, to where he was just a middling pitcher for the first half of the year and just caught fire at the end and won people championships. And I look at that, you know, those kind of hosses you want for a full season. So in terms of what we can take away from this year, I think we're going to see, you know, breakout guys, kind of like, you know, Corbin Burnes was a guy who was fantastic this year, who I think whose draft stock is going to go way up. Guys like that are going to be drafted maybe higher than they should because they haven't done it over a full season. I think guys that, you know, maybe didn't have as great a year this season, in the shortened season, may come at a more of a discount. So I think Bieber has certainly vaulted into that upper echelon. He's been so much better than everybody else. You've got to put him there. But in terms of this season, especially in pitching, I may put a little bit more stock in 2019 numbers than I do in 2020 numbers when I get ready to formulate my list next year.
I don't know if this is confirmation bias or not, but somebody might say, well, look at Scherzer and Verlander with the ages they're at and all the pitches they've thrown. Maybe just getting invested in a pitcher in his mid to late 30s isn't a good idea. But, you know, guys age differently. Randy Johnson was great into his late 30s. Nolan Ryan pitched into his 40s. Is age just a number? Is it just a case-by-case situation? What do you say to somebody who might think, you know what, I got burned by Verlander, I got burned by Scherzer, I don't want to draft old pitchers anymore. What would you say to that?
Well, I look at what Clayton Kershaw mm-hmm. has done. You know, he's come back and been one of the best pitchers in all of baseball this season when we counted him out. But we counted out Verlander a while back, too, after a couple of bad years or a year and a half with the Tigers. The ace pitchers, I think those are the guys that may be able to break the mold and bend the curve a little bit more. But, I mean, if you're looking at guys that are, you know, kind of mid-tier anyway, I can see fading those guys once they get past 32 or 33. But the ace guys who continue to do it, yeah, I suppose you could end up with a season like you got from, you know, from Steven Strasburg even this year, or Verlander. You get one start and that's it. But by and large, I think we've seen that pitching is now just as reliable, maybe sometimes even more so reliable at the top of the charts than it is for hitters.
I'm glad you mentioned Strasburg. I know you're in the Virginia, D.C. area, and Strasburg, of course, wins a championship last year. And then this year he makes one start and he's on the injured list. What's the temperature on Strasburg? How do you think you'll approach him next year?
I think I'll be cautious, but I'm still, I think, am going to be willing to buy in just because we knew that Strasburg had the type of skills to provide a season like he did last year. And finally, he put everything together and stayed healthy. I mean, sure, you'll probably have to have a bit of an injury discount on him, but I still think he's got everything that it takes to be able to be a successful pitcher. I won't be going in 100%, but I think I'm going to go in at 90%, and we'll probably end up with Strasburg in a couple of leagues next year.
Yeah, I think the market will probably give you a nice discount on Strasburg if you want to take that plunge. And it's at some point, you just have to start drafting for upside. Forget trying to be safe. I mean, you need guys who can be difference makers and can be league winners and can show up on that MVP page that I talked about. We're talking baseball with my friend Steve Gardner. You know him from USA Today Sports, and he's been a part of the fantasy baseball and fantasy sports industry for a long time. He's a heck of a good guy. And now we're going to pivot to our draft. We're going to go five rounds and talk about some of our favorites in the media landscape of female journalists. This can be writers. This can be broadcasters. This can be podcasters. Anything you want. The only rule I'm going to make is I'm not going to allow anybody who works for Yahoo to be drafted, only because I work with so many talented female colleagues. I just don't want to have to play favorites between Hannah Kaiser and Liz Loza and Liz Rocher and tons of other people who are just doing terrific work for us over at Yahoo. So they're going to be ineligible. I'm only going to pick people outside of the Yahoo family. Five rounds. Steve Gardner, you have the first pick in our female broadcast media draft.
Okay, Scott. It didn't take me a whole lot of time to think who should be the number one seed, the number one pick in this. So I apologize if I take the person that you were thinking about. But in terms of being at the top of her game, being in a marquee spot on network television, I don't think it gets any better than Doris Burke is right now. And with all of her knowledge, I mean, she knows the game. She knows the players. She knows the coaches. And she can do a little play-by-play, too, in addition to the commentary that she does from the courtside interviews and analysis. I think she's just fantastic. And I'm not a huge NBA fan, but if Doris Burke is doing a game, I'm probably going to stick around and watch.
Great pick. Would have been my first pick, too. I agree with everything you said at the top of her game. She was a basketball player at Providence College. She predated me at Providence by a few years and made much more of an impact at Providence than I ever did. But although I don't know if she wrote for the school paper like I did. But yeah, she could ball. She was Doris Sable back then. She was a baller in college. And she just, you know, she cut her teeth as a sideline reporter. And, you know, all those times where Popovich would be kind of rude to her and Doris would hold her ground. But then you see her work, you know, so she can do that bit, of course. But she called plenty of games under. She has her finger on the pulse of a game and can see subtle changes, nuances, trends. She understands the game inside and out. And she's, again, I thought she really proved her mettle in how she handled Popovich. She's somebody I would love to hear her call other sports, because I bet she'd be great at any sport that she was curious about. Because, again, she's just, you know, she's intellectually curious. And she knows when to talk. She knows when to let the action speak. A really good interviewer, which is a very underrated skill. You and I both come from print backgrounds, so we know how important interviewing is. I think she's a great pick at number one. I'm going to take another woman with New England ties. I'm going to take Jackie McMullen, who is you might know from ESPN, Boston Globe. She's actually just signed on to do some work at The Ringer, and I'm sure that work will be great. Hall of Fame writer, basketball writer. I grew up with the Boston Globe. I think it was the best sports section of all time in the 80s. Gammons, Shaughnessy was really good then. Bob Ryan, Will McDonough, Lee Montville. I could go on. And Jackie McMullen was part of that crew. And just unbelievable. Yeah, it wasn't easy. You know, back then, a female sports writer wasn't always welcomed with open arms. A lot of times they had to fight through a lot of rudeness and a lot of old attitudes. And you had to have a certain amount of toughness. Jackie also played basketball like Doris Burke did. I believe she was a basketball player at UNH. And when I was in college, I had a job at the Providence Journal. And I thought, I had an idea for an article. And I wrote a letter to Jackie McMullen about maybe writing about the 1986 draft and how many players had succumbed to drug problems. An idea that had probably any good writer had probably thought about 3 years earlier. And Jackie wrote me back a handwritten note, very kind, but hey, that's a good idea. And, you know, good luck with your writing and all that. Just really classy. I mean, I would like her if she never wrote me back, but I just thought that was cool. She's smart. She's really knowledgeable about all different sports. You see her on Around the Horn. You can see that. She knows football really well. She knows baseball really well. I just think Jackie McMullen is just an American treasure, and I've enjoyed her work for like 30 years.
Great pick. And, you know, it's funny because your experience with the Boston Globe sports section is similar to mine with the Washington Post sports section, which in its heyday,
you're gonna snipe me again, Gardner. You're going to snipe me again.
No,
I know it.
No, I'm not. I will throw this parenthetical in because, you know, with that Washington Post sports section with Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon, Tom Boswell, Christine Brennan, who is a colleague of mine at USA Today, was also part of that. And so I will disqualify her. But I have to say that was a fantastic sports section. And we have some pretty good writers, female writers at USA Today as well, with Christine, Nancy Armour, and the rest of the folks at our place. So I will back off because I was going to try and bend the rules maybe for my last pick. But I did want to shout out those women who are fantastic that I work with.
Absolutely.
So for my number two pick, or we're not doing a snake. I get the
snake. You have the two pick.
With my number two pick, I'm going to go back in history a little bit to one of the trailblazers in terms of television anchors, sports center anchors, not necessarily associated with sports anymore, but I think Robin Roberts deserves a place in, you know, when you're talking about great female sports casters and female in sports media, she's got to be on the list because, I mean, when SportsCenter, again, appointment viewing, if you saw Robin Roberts on TV, you knew that something big was happening. You knew that you were going to get a incredibly professional newscast. And I just think has got to be one of the, if the, I don't know if there's a Mount Rushmore of SportsCenter anchors, it would seem to me that Robin Roberts has got to be, if not on that Mount Rushmore, certainly in the conversation.
Yeah, a trailblazer, a legitimate, just a tough journalist, unafraid to ask difficult questions, somebody who always had her finger on the pulse of not just sports, but how does the sport that she's covering relate to the country, mm-hmm. to society, to different things? How does it relate to class issues, to race issues, to hot button topics of the moment? She just gets it. And you've seen she's been able to cross over into different non-sports areas because she's such a good journalist. You know, Robin Roberts is just a pro. And if you propped her into any situation and said, cover this, get to the story here, get to the gist of it, she would knock it out of the park. Just one of my longtime favorites. There's been so much good talent at ESPN. And she, to me, is right up there with anybody, a great career there. And of course, she's doing great work now with ABC. So that's an excellent pick in the second round. I'm going to try not to pick everybody who worked for the Boston Globe, but I got to mention Leslie Visser, mm-hmm. who was, again, a pioneer, very early, one of the first prominent female sports writers on a Murderer's Row sports section. And then she branched into television. She covered just about any sport. And just classy, smart, elegant, as certain, she understood, she's very efficient with her words. She could say a lot in few words. And I don't know, I just felt like if Leslie Visser was involved with the program, I just felt like there's a touch of class to it. And again, because I'm such a honk for the Boston Globe, I'm going to go with Leslie Visser in the second round.
All right. For my round three pick, you know, we talked a lot about TV folks and people who have made their mark on television. I'm going to go here to somebody who has made her mark in radio. And I, again, don't want to be focusing so much on the Northeast, but Susan Waldman of the New York Yankees baseball radio team, she and John Sterling have been together doing Yankees games for a decade plus. Man, how long has it been? I wish I should have looked that up. But I just think it's fabulous that she's been able to overcome such hatred, I think is probably an apt description of her as a woman trying to make it in a male-dominated sports world, especially baseball, you know, a very insulated clubhouse, it seems, you know, all teams, it seems, very reluctant to allow a female to come into and be, you know, a peer with them. And I think Susan Waldman has done a fantastic job. I mean, there are other broadcasters who have different styles that may be more appealing. I just have to say I am in awe that she's been able to continue to do this, do such a great job. I mean, go from a radio reporter, so she's got the reporting chops. Remember listening to her on WFAN, you know, driving and tuning in sports radio out in the middle of nowhere, and to be able to rise to not only a color analyst position in Major League Baseball, but with the most visible team in all of the major leagues, I just think is fantastic. So I'm really in awe of what she's accomplished in her career.
Great pick. And you really hit the key point that she's working for the Yankees. There's nowhere to hide. You know, it's not like she's, you know, doing some, you know, single A, you know, work that nobody's listening to. This is maybe the most branded, popular franchise in sports. Mm-hmm. So if you can't cut your teeth, if you're not doing a good job, you're going to get called out. And her, you know, the work that she's done and her longevity speaks for itself. A great pick and somebody I have a lot of admiration for. You know, I'm not sure if you have, I'm not positive this person would be ineligible for you or not, but I have to pick them because they're just one of my favorite writers. I've always loved Sally Jenkins, the great Bloodlines. Her father, the late Dan Jenkins, was one of the great sports writers of all time. And you should go back in the SI Vault and read all of his old pieces, especially if you're a golf fan like I am. Man, I'll just go back and read. Oh, they're at Winged Foot. I'll read the 1974 Winged Foot recap that Jenkins wrote. But Sally is equally outstanding as a sports writer. And I just look at the way she covers tough topics, the way she's held Roger Goodell's feet to the fire when he screwed up, and the way she handled the Deflategate thing. And I feel like Sally Jenkins writes two kinds of columns, whether I write it and like, oh, wow, I agree with all of this, she's hitting all the right boxes, or, oh, wow, this, I disagree with this, and I realize I must be wrong because I'm disagreeing with Sally Jenkins. Unbelievable. And you know, the ability to cover games and write on deadline, to write topical columns, to have a unique point of view. She's outstanding. I've been a huge fan of hers for a very long time, and I still think she's at the top for
game. Wasn't she nominated for Pulitzer last year for commentary? I think she was in among the finalists for that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised because, again, I think she's of all the people I have on this list, she may be my favorite writer. Some of these other people maybe have more broadcasting experience than she does. But I mean, Sally Jenkins, you know, just, I think, an equal to her father, who was a titan in the industry.
Nope. And I subscribe to The Washington Post being, you know, here in the D.C. area, and always look forward to seeing whenever she has something to write. So that's, I heartily endorse that pick.
Okay, fourth round.
All right, fourth round. I'm going to go again back to, well, radio, online, television. I think this person doesn't get the credit that she deserves for all the great things that she does. And I happen to say that I may be a little bit biased because I consider her a friend of mine. It's Marley Rivera of ESPN. And if you're not maybe familiar with her, she works in a lot of the ESPN Deportes stuff, but also is bilingual and is a fantastic person that a lot of times we in the media kind of ask to help translate or serve as a translator sometimes when Spanish-speaking athletes, mostly baseball players, because that's what she normally covers, but you know, when they are trying to talk with us. So I think she just does a fantastic job. Doesn't get the credit she deserves, but still is on video stuff, does video work, does in-depth reporting, does audio broadcast, radio, and is just so well-rounded and so good at her job that I think deserves to be a bigger star than she already is.
A great pick. The versatility speaks for itself, the ability to speak different languages and to tap into areas that other journalists can't do, you know.
And she gets scoops with a lot of the Spanish-speaking guys. You know, Yasiel Puig, I remember one where she was the first person to be able to land a one-on-one interview with him, that sort of thing.
And that stuff's so much more important now as we see the world become smaller, and this, you know, the American sports world has so many non-Americans in it. You know, being able to be conversant in those discussions is a great skill to have. And again, just showcases how much talent there is over at ESPN. A great pick in the fourth round. I'm going to take, you know, if you were to ask me, I don't want to commoditize people, but if there is stock you could buy in a reporter, you know, who's going to the moon? Who's like really good right now? Who's going to be a superstar? That's what I see with Mina Kimes over at ESPN. Knows every sport. She's smart. She's funny. She can think on her feet. I just, every time I see her on ESPN program, and I know her profile has increased, they've signed her to a contract extension and they've promoted her and everything. And she just knows her stuff A to Z. And I think she's going to be there for a long time. And we're going to look back at, you know, she's going to be one of the people that maybe she's on the Mount Rushmore in 20 years. I think she's that talented and, you know, just a rising star in the business. And, I give ESPN credit for recognizing that and giving her a higher profile. She's just really, really smart analyst and funny. I mean, we're all in this because we love sports, but you have to be able to understand what's going on in pop culture and where the world is at, and to see silly connections. And you know, she's just a, I think, a perfect modern sports writer.
Yeah, and a fantastic in-depth too. What was that? There was a piece that she wrote. Oh man, I'm hanging myself out to dry now. But it was maybe a year or two ago. Just wrote a really super in-depth piece that, when you say, oh, well, she's just on TV and she's good at thinking on her feet. This was something that took a lot of reporting and writing and was, really long and in-depth that was really impressive. I wish I could think of that right off the top of my head. But we must move on. We must move on.
Fifth round. Make it count.
Fifth round. There are, my list is still so terribly long. I mean, I've got to give a shout out to Stefania Bell, who we play fantasy baseball with in our labor mixed league.
Hall of Famer.
And a fantasy sports Hall of Famer, and all the great job that she does. But I'm going to lean away from picking another ESPN person officially, although I love Stefania to death. Somebody I think I will go with your trajectory on your last pick, a rising star I think is really good, can do a lot of different things. Primarily, though, I read her for baseball, and it's Britt Giroli of The Athletic. She used to cover the Baltimore Orioles. She's now the beat writer for The Athletic for the Washington Nationals. Interesting person and well-rounded person. She's a power lifter and has written a couple of different things for The Athletic about that part of her life. But in terms of baseball, again, a very, very crisp writer, a very good writer, a very detailed writer. And she wrote a series with The Athletic back when there were no sports, looking back on some of her previous years covering the Orioles and some of the inner locker room kind of things that you don't get a chance to write about on a regular basis. But because there was an opportunity to do that, that was fascinating. And especially for somebody who's kind of been in and out of clubhouses every so often, certainly not to the degree that a beat writer has, but to see some of her insights and how things, things that she picks up on and is able to turn into stories. I don't really know her that well at all personally. I've met her, I've come in contact with her a handful of times, and we follow each other on Twitter, but I think she's just a very good up-and-coming, rising star kind of writer, and you'll want to check some of her stuff out if you haven't seen it.
A great pick, and man, The Athletic, just the talent they have on that roster, male, female, they have so many bases covered, and as somebody who came up in the print game, I'd like to see The Athletic, succeed. I subscribe to it, and I encourage other people to do it. A really good fantasy department too. So that's a great pick with Britt. I'm a big fan of her work. I still have a bunch of people on my board, and maybe I'll give a shout out to some of these people at the end. I might have picked Tara Sullivan, but she's another Boston Globe person. And if I pick one more Boston Globe person, you'll accuse me of having stock in the company. Katie Nolan's, I think, a star over at NFL Network. She used to work for Yahoo briefly, and I think she's super talented. I'm sorry, Kay Adams. I mean, Kay. I have Katie Nolan and Kay Adams written next to each other. It's Kay Adams at the NFL Network. Katie Nolan, of course, is at ESPN now. They're both really, really smart, talented. Mary Carrillo on tennis is one of my favorites. Andrea Kramer's terrific. Melissa Jacobs is in the fantasy space and does a great job with her work. Liz Merrill's takeout features are great. I'm mentioning 8 million people. But I knew my final pick was going to be Janie McCauley. She's a Bay Area AP bureau writer. And she covers a lot of A's games and 49ers games, Warriors stuff. And she has to write on deadline. And she has to understand the gist of a story really quickly and turn it around and try to write what you would call in journalism a PM lead, where you're writing it on deadline, but you want it to actually be something somebody could read 12 hours after the game is over. And she's so good, man. She just, and I know I've been in those press boxes. I know how hard it can be that a game just ended and maybe it took a bunch of twists and turns and your story that you've started to write is all scrapped and you get to write something in 15 minutes or 20 minutes and maybe even get some quotes in the meantime. And I just enjoy reading her. Even if she writes on something, this is the one thing that you find with writers you enjoy. like we both said, we're not huge NBA fans, but if Doris Burke is doing a game, we're interested. Again, I'm not a huge NBA fan. I listened to the Jackie McMullen podcast with Bill Simmons and I loved it because Jackie's just so good. And her and Bill have a really good chemistry too. If Janie McCauley writes a story on something, I don't even care if I'm interested in what she's writing about. I just enjoy her work so much that and the craft of it and knowing the genesis of it from my background as a newspaper guy. So I think she's just an outstanding AP's been smart to have her locked up for a long time because she's been doing this, I don't know, 20, 25 years. But and I think it's kind of a hidden gem because, you know, I don't know that everybody in the country, you may have read Janie McCauley's work and not known it because it may just be AP, you know, AP story without the name on the byline. But I have so much respect for people who can be topical and smart and see the big picture when there's like 10 minutes to figure it out.
That's a great point. And I'm glad we got somebody out to on the West Coast as well to be able to.
Right. Yeah. So much East Coast bias, so much East Coast bias. I also want to mention Lori Rubinson was on my list. You may have remembered her from the first season of Dream Job. She's a WFAN host and a really cool follow on Twitter. And she's also good friends with Lauren Michaels, I believe, our friend from Fantasy Baseball, who we lost a couple of years ago. Just a really good presence. And I could go on and on. I don't know if I mentioned Dottie Pepper. She's a golf announcer who I really like. There's so many good ones. It's a golden age. We're seeing more different, unique people with points of view getting to sports media. And I think that just serves everybody well. So I'm glad we could spotlight some of them. And, you know, we'll call back 10 years from now. We'll see who won this draft. I think because I have Mina Kimes, I'll probably be viewed as the winner. But you never know. You know, your team could rally.
I still have the top seed, though. Doris Burke is pretty good.
Oh, so. I know. Oh, God, she's so good. Let's go Friars, man. And she could play. She was a good. She was, I believe, a starter at Providence too. I mean, she wasn't sitting on the bench drinking Gatorade. I mean, she could ball, and she's tough. She would take a charge.
That's what you want in your reporters, right there. The mentality to be able to take a charge.
By the way, do you miss your newspaper desk?
You know, it's weird because I went from broadcast to print right around the time that the internet was kicking in, and we were fighting with the print side for the online side. And I sort of got pulled into print more so than I went in that direction initially. So it's again one of those hybrid type careers that you have to be able to do all sorts of different kinds of things to be able to survive.
I'm so glad you said that, because when people ask for advice, not that I got the whole world figured out, but, you know, be versatile would be the first thing I would say is say yes to anything. If you can do it, say yes to it and be versatile. You know, don't be a writer, be a podcaster. You try to get on radio, learn how to write on Deadline, learn how to write a feature. You know, don't box yourself in, acquire as many different skills as you can. I think that will be, and you never know. I mean, you could start in sports, you could end up in PR, you know, you could end up in you could start covering sports. You might end up being a political writer or a movie reviewer or something like that. It just never hurts to have toes dipped in different waters. We've been talking to Steve Gardner today. You can follow him on Twitter at Steve A. Gardner, our friend from USA Today Sports, the kingpin of labor. Steve, tell everybody how they can keep up with you and what you're working
on. Sure. You can follow me, as Scott said, on Twitter at Steve A. Gardner. Also, check out my work at usatoday.com. In baseball, fantasy, could be any number of things, but as we get into the baseball playoffs, probably we'll be doing a lot more of that sort of reporting and writing. And also, if you happen to come by a newsstand or see actual print products, USA Today Sports Weekly, I've got a fantasy column coming out in my last one for the season on Monday with fantasy awards and everything else, or on Wednesday is when it comes out. So, check that out if you can.
We'll definitely check that out. Learned a lot. Had a lot of fun today with our friend Steve Gardner. Thank him for coming on today. Thank our producer Raghu on the West Coast, staying up late, keeping us sounding good. I'm Scott Pianowski. Remember, we have fantasy football 5 days a week. We have this podcast on Mondays. I believe we have another episode next week, and then we'll call it a season. For Steve, for Raghu, I am Scott. Good luck in the final week. Bring home that championship. We'll talk to you soon.
I'm I'm Liz Loza, and every day the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast gets you ready for the week ahead.
Just take Josh Allen, Andy.
Oh, no. Oh, no. This is a terrible response.
I like him based on the volume he got last week.
Even against this tough run defense.
No, the run defense sucks.
We're talking pickups, trades, predictions, and bets 5 times a week to get you prepped for game day. So go ahead and subscribe to the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast. And while we can't promise you'll win your league, we guarantee you'll have a good time.